So we're really picking up where we, what we began last time, which is looking at the Trinity. And I'll do a little bit of a rehearsal of what I talked about before, not a lot. A lot of what I talked about was very influenced by Jonathan Edwards, who's the famous Puritan theologian, whose work on the Trinity and the nature of God is quite breathtaking, quite astonishing. And I think I shared with you the opening sentence last time of his great essay, the unpublished essay on the Trinity. I took it further. Sounds a bit immodest to say that, but I guess I took it more deeply into language and how language is, our daily experience of language is a living experience of the Trinity. So I'll continue on that vein today. And I asked people, you know, if we wanted to develop this Trinitarian theology, how would they like to go? And no one gave me any helpful advice. They said, do whatever interests you. So that was famous last words. And tonight we're going to do... get a fair way into the Trinity and creativity as our working title. Now, so let's begin by a problem statement, or what I see as problematic for a lot of Christians today. And that is the nature of our engagement with the world. What is the nature of the engagement our faith might have publicly with the world? And more and more, I think that door is being opened, and more people are seeing that Christians should have an influence in the world. And of course, we talk about that quite a lot in gospel conversations. The problems are characterised by, that I see, once you open that gate, are that what a lot of people do is that here I am, I'm a Christian, and I've got my faith, and there's a growing theology that says, well, don't box that into the church, it's for the whole world. And so now, here's the world, stuff out here, buildings and people and so on. And the opening up of the gospel that says we should have a real influence on the world creates a bridge. But the problem is that what I see everywhere are Christians are taking a traditional gospel into the world. And it's the gospel of ethics. Essentially, so this open bridge doesn't change who I am and what I'm about. I just transport across their ethics. So I'll give you a sad example of this, which was a recent example of a group of people who are trying to open up the space of how I'm a Christian at work. How am I a Christian at work? And these people showed a video, and there was a pamphlet of the target audience, young professional, 30-something, you know, working in the city, and this anguished Christian is wandering along saying, how can I take my faith from Sunday to Monday, right? Assuming the faith on Sunday is fine, of course, it's just a distribution problem, okay? Marketing problem. So he's wandering along saying, how can I take my faith to work? I don't get the sufficient encouragement in my church to help me do that. I need to face issues like swearing at work. How do I confront swearing at work? And drinking at work and alcohol binging. How can I confront those issues? And when I saw this video, I just put my head in my hands. You know, there's this idea that we are the audit policemen of the universe, you know, internal audit group of the universe, and And we've got a checklist to check behaviour. This is the wonderful contribution we're making to the world. And this guy was just, that was all he talked about. And I can tell you that in 25 or more years of working with organisations, I've yet to confront any of those issues in a way that was at all problematic. But there's almost a sense that when, you know, the nature of this engagement we have is, as I say, if I have a legalistic Christianity here, it's a legalistic Christianity I'll take out to me. And there's a great danger that as the door is opening and the bridge is opening, what the world will hear is fundamentalist policemen bossing them around and telling them what to do. And so the question tonight is, I don't think many of us here would aspire to be like that. The question is, what's an alternative nature of engagement? Now, let me frame this problem a little bit more precisely with this model, which I think I've begun to understand a little bit more. I think, Mark, you would understand more deeply than I would. But there's a bit of passage in the decline of Christianity over 2,000 years along an axis, along this particular axis, the public-private axis, where for a variety of reasons, and I went one of the lectures I went to at Regent would blame the Reformation for it. For a variety of reasons, Christianity's got pushed back into the private sphere. So we all live like that today. It's fine, you've got your faith, just keep it to yourself. I don't care what you believe, it's great. It's a private experience. And we're in a culture where it's actually, to have a public experience is wrong, it's intrusive, it's rejected. So does that make sense to people, that move? Now, I guess I'm very aware that you know, traditionally we're kind of stuck over here. I'm very aware of that in my life. What I guess I was not aware of is this phenomenon can be traced throughout, it was 2,000 years of history and it wasn't always there. So that's the first point. And I think the guy who wrote the book on the Reformation just got published. If you want to read it, his name is Brad Gregory. The book is The Unintended Consequences of the Reformation, the Secularisation of the Western World. So I won't go into his argument, but I think it makes sense for people. So we're boxed over here. That's one issue for us. The other issue is an issue that you could almost call the there's a sacred secular split. So I'm going to get myself confused on this one here. So there's, and I have an experience that's metaphysical or sacred, and I'm allowed to have that experience versus an experience that's practical and grounded in the world. And the combination of Platonic Christianity and the privatization has boxed most of us here. So you've got, it's a private faith and it's a metaphysical faith and doesn't challenge it. It's actually very, it's not very threatening to the world. If we're down in this box here, it's not very threatening to anybody. Because, you know, you could be kooky, I don't care, it's not interfering with me, etc. Now, what's happening for a variety of reasons is Christians, and it's very evident in North America, politically very, very evident, are breaking out of that box, right here. And I guess there's a movement this way, that if you have this kind of Platonic metaphysical Christianity and, you know, a religiously framed Christianity, taking it public is probably, you know, a version of what I talked about over here. It's a, I can take that intense fundamentalist faith public, and I you know, at the scariest end, I'm Sarah Palin. Scariest end. I'm going to boss the whole world around and do it my way. Okay, and the sphere that I think we're all interested in is would be this one here on the top right, which is what's actually a practical, grounded, holistic way of engaging publicly. What's the legitimate way? What's our worldview here? And that's the, I think, I can't give answers to that tonight, but I think that's the project. That is now, I think, people, a lot of theologians have kind of broken the walls down, that the earth, and you know, is our inheritance. We've got something to say, that's a more and more common agenda. The question is, what do we say and how do we say it up in that space? And that's like, I think, a developmental project. Does that make sense to people, that model? So, I don't pretend that there are easy answers to this. What I am trying to do tonight is take a big step back and look at this from a really fundamental view. I'll continue to use Jonathan Edwards as a lot of my inspiration. And the idea of engagement in the world, I'm going to look at in a series of topics. The first is, why is this important to God? Why is our engagement in the cosmos important to God? And clearly I'm going to talk about that engagement being a creative engagement. That'll be the first bit. And then I'll go on and talk about what's the nature of creation and creativity. What do we mean by that phrase? Then I will talk about, the order is wrong here. I think I've got myself a little bit confused. Let me just check that. The second one will not be, the what is the nature of creation is the third one. The second part will be who, which is really, what's our role in the creative project of God? What is, and by our, I mean humanity. And then I will move on to how do we exercise that. So if we said that we're looking at creativity, why is that important to God? How are we involved? Why are humans so central? What does it mean, and how does it work? What faculties do we have to exercise that? So that will structure the talk tonight. So let's look at the sort of why one to start with, and why this is important to God. I've done a little slide presentation for part of the answer to this one, which I'll now revert to. And and this slide presentation is really relying a fair bit, or not relying, trying to share with you some of the wonder of Edwards's writing. Last time, the one that I talked about was the unpublished essay on the Trinity. This one is equally famous. It's the title is magnificent. The title is "The Ends for Which God Created the Universe." Why don't you write an essay on that? A little bit bold, don't you think? The ends for which God created the universe. It's a very, very ambitious title, but it's terribly important. It's the biggest why question of all. Why did he create anything? That's the question that Edwards confronts in what is an astonishingly brilliant answer that I think I'll read regularly for the rest of my life from time to time, because, and I want to give you a taste of that tonight. Now, I warn you, his prose is difficult. Part of the reason his prose is difficult is because he's a 18th century writer, but the main reason is because he's super bright. So every clause, every adjective is sort of dripping with meaning, if you know it. It's not like our monosyllabic, you know, sound bites that we've all been tuned to. So you've got to put a bit of effort into Edwards. So let's have a look at this. Here we go. So this is partly a reprisal for those of you who were not here of the Trinity and the Trinitarian nature of God. Now, I'm not going to go over everything I said before about Edwards and the Trinity, but this model on the board is, let's get inside this model. This is a model of the Trinity, and the highlights are that what Edwards did for the notion of the Trinity was that he was very influenced by Newton and Newton's theory of gravity. And if you think about what Sir Isaac Newton did to the world, he turned the worldview of everybody away from structure to motion as the ultimate building block for reality. It's very, very simple, and I explained it last time, that here is a pen made of stuff, and here's a carpet made of stuff, and I want to know what reality is, so in the structural view of reality, I got inside. If I understood all the bits and pieces in this bit here, and if I understood all the bits and pieces in the carpet, I don't understand that. That's force and motion. So he turned the view, if you think about it, step back, the view of reality becomes dynamic, not static. Does that make sense to you? Now, Edwards was a great example for Christians because he was not in a religious box. He was totally engaged in philosophy, history, science, mathematics, aesthetics. The whole world was God's template as far as he was concerned. And so he took that to say, well, therefore, he reconceptualized the Trinity as dynamic and moving. Now, this is important because he now has a God who intrinsically is acting and moving. This is very important to get that in your mind. Not static. You know, it's not like God's basic nature is, and then someone wakes him up and says, oh, I better move and do something. No, no, no. God is eternally restless, eternally moving, eternally ambitious, eternally in motion. That's the heart of God. And it's Trinitarian. Now, if God were but an Islamic God, one lump, that wouldn't mean anything because a big lump can't move. Or it could move outside of itself but not inside of itself. Do you see what I mean? If ultimate reality is just one big lump, it doesn't have any movement in it. But if it's three in one, then there's dynamism between the three. So another way of putting it was his view of God was a system, not a unit. Or God was a family, not an individual. So rather than these things being derivative, you know, even in our, the way I think, you know, Mark, you and I have talked about this a lot, who am I? You know, the modern world says, look inside yourself, you're an individual unit. No, no, you're not. You're in a web of relationships. And we tend to think a relationship is derivative. Get myself right, then I'll be able to handle you. The Trinity says, no, 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 the heart of me is all my web of relationships. I can't break that down. So Edwards got into this world and reconceptualized the Trinity as in motion. The big innovation he made over against his peers was he saw that motion was not mechanical but spiritual. So Newton had seen the heart of all things is, you know, the mechanism of the universe is gravity and force and energy. So Edwards took all of those things, but he turned them into character. And he borrowed a lot on Aristotelian views of habit. And so what you've got here is you see this little bit here. The fuzzy bit is what he called the idea. Now, the word he used was habit. Not very useful word for us. It's changed so much. So a more modern word might be disposition. And a biblical word would be the intent. So there's a driving I don't know about you, but now look into yourselves. You know, at the heart of what drives you. I mean, Edwards is going to go to the heart of what is in us all is a drive. Inchoate, pre-verbal, there's a drive in me. And it's a drive not just for physical growth, but for development, expression, etc. So he says this is actually us sharing the character of God. And he called that variously the idea or the source of agency. And this will map onto the Father. Now, if there is this dynamism, the dynamism we want to express itself. So pull the word apart, express, press out. And the pressing out is towards the idea of the idea, was his phrase, which becomes Christ, the Logos, the expression of the idea. And if you express an idea, all of us have this experience. We don't express ideas merely for functional reasons. We express ideas to enjoy them. So the feedback loop is joy, which is the Holy Spirit. So that's all the unpublished essay on the Trinity, and it's stunning when you get into it. Stunning. But it's why he believed that joy sluiced through the universe. You know how so often we have a view of God as a bit cranky, parsimonious, hard to please, you know, bit of a doomsday merchant. Well, for Edwards, happiness frames the universe. And happiness is in God. It is the heart of his character, is unbridled ecstasy. And that structures the universe and will structure the universe. So the new heaven and the new earth will be structured by joy. Edwards said, pretty good stuff, isn't it? So this means God is intrinsically wanting to create. The essence of this is if that's the character of God, God will intrinsically want to create. Now, therefore, he's talking about now, I'm going to give you four big words about God. This is very important stuff as to the big why of God. The essence was the word he used, and now I've given you some phrases. The essence of God, he says, are the glorious attributes of God. These are all quotes from this essay. His infinite power, wisdom, righteousness, and goodness. So this is his deep, deep characteristics and attributes. He says something terribly important, which I think he was the first person to really break through on. And that is this. No notion of God's last end in creation can imply insufficiency and mutability in God, or any dependence on the creature for any part of his happiness or perfection. Now this is, he's going to get very precise about this, but he's going to appear to completely contradict in a moment. You've got to really go with this guy here. I've just had the joy of listening to John Walton explain how that second sentence there, this second sentence was completely foreign to any human being on the earth, any religious system on the earth prior to Moses. What John called the great symbiosis was in fact the gods were inside the system and they were needy and bitchy and we were their slaves. It was the opposite of the right hand. The gods depended on the creatures for their happiness and work. And the whole religious system was a bartering system between an underling of slaves and gods who are bitchy. And I wanted to keep all the gods on my side. Does that make some little bit of a sense to you? That was the whole ancient Near Eastern context. The concept of a God who did not need anything was in fact beyond change, was totally... You know, one of the single most stunning thing that I have come from Ian Proven and John Walton is what I thought when I was young was sheer common sense. That is that the proposition of God is that he is eternal outside the system and he made the system and he's infinitely holy. I thought that's, well, you know, you could be an atheist or a believer, but I thought that's just kind of in the air. Everyone believes that. That is the greatest that is as great a revelation to humankind as Jesus Christ was. Because nobody, Egypt, Assyria, Persia, Hittites, had anything like that. So what we think is obvious when we read the Old Testament was stunningly innovative to everybody. So for Edwards to write that, you know, we all say, yes, of course. Well, the whole of the ancient world, I mean, we're probably going back now, you know, pre-New Testament, wasn't able to say that. So, but the problem that people had with the second part, which mostly, you know, the fathers and Christians had always believed the second part, is it leaves me with a God who can't have change in him. And change, therefore, is bad. This is a really important point for us. I can remember Sarah, our daughter, asking a great question in a Bible study. Can God learn? Can God learn? Is God surprised? So, you know, the very traditional answer is not at all. He totally knows everything. Go to woe. There's not an ounce of turning in him. And so, therefore, we have a very static God. And this is the view that Edwards will change. But he's changing it, saying, nonetheless, no matter what I'm going to say, I cannot say that God needed anything. So this is the essence of God. Here's his argument. So we've established the concept of the essence. But now he says, because this God is dynamic, he said it seems desirable. By the way, he develops the first half of his paper as an argument. He uses words like it seems, it's probable that. You know, he's doing a mental speculation. It seems desirable that the attributes of God should be exerted. This is work. He starts to now use not essence words, but work word. If I've said God is dynamic, it seems desirable that he should want to exert himself in producing effects that manifest his infinite power, wisdom, and goodness. So now he's beginning to use very different language on effects. Manifest, it seems natural. If I have the essence of God intrinsically communicating with himself, intrinsically loving, intrinsically moving. And so I will now see in this kind of, I will see an infinite amplification. So we now get into exercise, not essence. If the world had not been created, these attributes would never have had any exercise. The power of God would forever have been dormant and useless as to any effect. See what he's arguing? If you actually have a totally self-sufficient God, he's locked up in himself, then there's never any manifestation of it. He's saying it's very natural that there should be an exercise in order that it should be manifested. So he now introduces the point that God is intrinsically expansive, not just creative. He's interested in infinite expansion. He therefore doesn't want things to stay the same. So, second big point. Third big point is, what's the goal of the exercise? And his answer is to be known. To be known. God has no greater joy than in himself. He will say, the excellency is in himself, and he knows himself wonderfully, and he wishes to be known more. Sounds like an incredible self-centeredness, and I mean, if you're God, fair enough. I mean, and he does later on in this essay cover that. Well, am I talking about a selfish, you know, narcissistic God? He covers that. But God is interested only in the knowledge of himself. If we have a Trinitarian God, it will become in the knowledge of his Son. In the knowledge of his Son, because that's who, that's within the Trinity, that was the Word. So he wants, like, who here has ever wanted to be an artist, a writer, a dramatist, something like that, right? You know, actor. Like, are you thrilled if nobody read a single word you wrote? Like, no one came and applauded you, wrote, put on Hamlet and there's no audience? What does that feel like? It's going to feel pretty rotten.
Waste of time.
That's a total waste of time. So that's what God is. I want someone to read my work. Is in a sense what he's saying. We, we can more and more look into our own experience to understand this drive of God. He wants to be known. And it's not a bad thing in the slightest, but nonetheless, so he's going to go into this, which is, it seems desirable, same argument structure, that the glorious perfections of God should be known, and the operations and expressions of them be seen by other beings beside himself. It seems desirable that we should, that this exercise should create knowledge. That's what it's there for. Normally, if we're exercising, we're doing it to achieve something. I lack something. I'm doing work to achieve something. Not the goal. Goal is that I just advertise myself. That's my goal, that I be known more broadly. This is very intrinsic to his argument. I like this picture. Because this is the people who are going to do the knowing. You know, and I think kids finding out about stuff and the most glorious thing with little babies for all of us who are parents, of course, is just watching this little baby lying there looking at light or moving curtains. They're just like wide-eyed because we're bored. It's like, you know, oh, we've got to prove it, we can't see anything. It's got, you know, no miracle. Whereas babies are just wide-eyed with light. They've got it right. We've got it wrong. The wide-eyed wonder, you know, so that's what I had there. Of course, the picture of us doing a facilitation in Zurich, so it continues on to, but it's all discovery. And here he says, now we're getting into some of the wonderful, thick prose of Edwards, it is a thing infinitely good in itself that God's glory should be known by a glorious society of created beings, and that there should be an increasing knowledge of God to all eternity. If existence, essence, is more worthy than non-existence, then so is knowledge. And if any knowledge, then the most excellent sort of knowledge, that of God and his glory. It's a marvelous sentence expressing the purpose of God, that we should know him. I mean, I think we all would intuitively agree with Edwards, but the great phrase of Alexander Pope, what I've often thought but there so well expressed. The important point that he's making is that this is good in itself. To knowledge, we're not knowing something in order to accomplish some other task. And God is not sharing knowledge in order that something... For those of you who know the ABCD model, the opening of this essay, it's the most straight ABCD thing I've ever... He separates ends and means, ends and means, ends and means. And he wants the ultimate end, behind which there is... It's no longer a bridge to anywhere else. He talks about health. Edwards talks about health. He says, I want a medicine. Why do I want a medicine? Because I want to be healthy. The medicine is a goal. Is the medicine a goal? No, it's not really a goal. Health's the goal. Do you know what I mean? He keeps on going back and back. So what's the goal of health? What's the ultimate why is how he begins this essay. So what's God's ultimate why? Not a pathway to any other why. This was where one of my big breakthroughs is saying redemption is a pathway to somewhere else. You can't say God's purpose was redemption. That's a means to some other end. Why did he want to redeem us? You know, doesn't answer the question. So he's trying to answer the question. And the final thing is this joy, this knowledge will create joy. It's no good if it's, you know, scholastic dry knowledge for Edwards. He wrote a whole book on the affections of it's called the Religious Affections. A whole book on it, quite famous for it. So delight is his word. You can begin to see, by the way, that this mirrors the nature of the Trinity, who are themselves knowing each other and delighting in each other. Father wakes up and says to the Son, you're beautiful. Wow, it's fantastic. You know, he wants us to share that conversation, that the Trinity, because the opening sentence of the unpublished essay in the Trinity is that God is enjoying himself and infinitely happy in himself. That was when I stopped reading it. He said, I think it begins something like it's a commonplace truth that everyone understands, that God is infinitely happy in the contemplation of himself. Well, I've never thought of that in my life. You know, he's infinitely happy in the and he wants us to share the contemplation. So if it is desirable that God's glory should be known, then it seems reasonable it should be delighted in and esteemed. So he is talking about joy. They're three good examples of joy. Very different. That's Lippius's father and Max. Lippius's father is 83 and blind and met Jesus 40 years ago, and he's an apostle of God, converted from warrior kingdom. You know, he wasn't a cannibal, but he was a killer of many men. Now he knows over half the New Testament by heart and has led tens of thousands of Papuans to Christ. And I Mark Mayhew and I met him. I wish I'd had the video camera on, because he's blind. And he and Max are great warriors together in the gospel. And so they play a trick on him when Max goes there. They don't tell him it's Max. And this guy comes out to meet him. When he reaches out and realizes it's Max, he just starts to explode. He's not speaking in tongues. He just goes, and he's just like, you think this guy's going to take off any moment. He just trembles with joy. Trembles with joy. And he's playing a musical instrument here. He spends literally half his waking hours in prayer with other people. You know, he enjoys God. And, you know, this is a great... And I think this is joy too. You know, it's art, it's wow. It's a wow factor of just celebration. So he says, if the perfection itself be excellent, then the knowledge of it is also excellent, and so is the esteem and love of it excellent. The love of the heart seems to be especially valuable. So this is God's end purpose, is this ecosystem of love, knowledge, and appreciation of the attributes of God. That is the final end of the whole created purpose for Edwards. The end of all things. He says this is magnificent stuff. You need kind of Beethoven playing behind it. As there is an infinite fullness of all possible good in God, and this fullness is capable of emanation ad extra, so it emanating as in flowing out beyond itself, so it seems valuable this fountain of good should send forth abundant streams. Such an emanation is, in some sense, a multiplication. This is a very, very important principle of Edwards. There is multiplication in God. Intrinsic in God is enlargement and multiplication of himself. This is the logical extension of his movement to see the Trinity as dynamic. It's logical. It all flows from it logically. Thus, it appears reasonable to suppose that it was God's last end that there should be a glorious emanation of his infinite fullness outside himself, and that the disposition to communicate himself or diffuse his own fullness was what moved him to create the world. This disposition in God as an original property of his nature was what excited him to create the world. Thus, the whole universe, in all its actings, proceedings, revolution, and entire series of events, every wheel in all its rotations, should move with a constant regard to him as the ultimate end of all, as if the whole system were animated and directed by one common soul. So this is his picture of a universe animated by God. I didn't think I could do much better than to give you some of his own words, so that's why I thought I'd begin with that. And hopefully encourage you that it's worth the effort to have a bit of a go at that essay, which is available on the internet. Just type it in. Ends which God created the world. So I'll just pause there and just sort of ask if there's any reflection or comment on that sort of rather breathtaking, I think, picture of the purpose of God.
That summary is very, very similar to what's in the Colossians, which I think Paul puts it more clearly.
I'm sure Paul does.
Christ is, so that Christ might be all in all. Christ.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a very Colossians type picture of all things.
And the concept of joy, in Proverbs chapter 8, it talks about wisdom being God's creator, God's co-creator, if you like, or being with God and rejoicing in the inhabited world.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
It's all there.
Yeah, it is.
When you're talking about redemption, I'm thinking about the Exodus. There's a lovely verse. I think it's in Exodus. It's in Exodus somewhere. God says, look how what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So obviously that was his purpose, to bring them to himself and so he could show them what he was like.
What he's like, that you might know me. It's so much of those Exodus promises are that you might know.
Yes.
That you might know, that you might know. And yeah. And even the whole idea that what we see in the Bible is exertion. You know, that God acting in history, God acting. So the enlargement, this is wonderful stuff. In practice, the enlargement happens on many scales. I mean, I think it happens for all of us. I would invite all of us to view our lives at the goal of God in our lives, therefore, is for us to participate in the enlargement. It's a much better word than sanctification or whatever, which tends to become sin spotting for most Christians, you know, like detoxification. Whereas enlargement is a bigger project, you know. God wants us to grow. This is very important. You know, I mean, I know. I said I would give detours of, you know, examples of how this stuff certainly structures my life, but you know, the last 18 months have been, you know, economically very difficult for our firm, and hence for my wife and I who own it, and it's tough. It's really tough. So the question that but now when I go through tough times, you know, somebody once said, "Don't waste a crisis." And so, very practically speaking, I mean, what I'm interested in life personally now is enlargement. You know, when I'm 70, I don't want to be some whinging, like, you know, 14-year-old in kind of wrinkled skin. I would like to be a 70-year-old who's enlarged, with broader shoulders, you know, able to take a crisis without panicking and so on. And, you know, depending on what your personality is, you'll respond differently to a crisis. Some people will, you know, get angry, and some people will, you know, become morose and whatever. Well, this is stuff we've just got to grow out of, rather than saying, is it a sin how I'm feeling? When I was younger, I thought, my job in this situation is to spot the sin. Oh, I'm being sinful here because I'm not trusting God. It's just rubbish stuff. I mean, life's tough. I haven't been through this before. I'm liable to stumble. You know, I'm liable to go into this. And so, but if the goal is enlargement, now my job is to learn, tutor my soul, push, think, so that out of this particular event that life has delivered to me, I'm a stronger person than I was 18 months ago. Does that make sense? So to me, this idea of enlargement is extremely practical. And I personally use a diary to structure it. And one of the things that talks I'd like to give is teach you how to do the same thing. And I keep a journal and, you know, meditate and write and think about my reactions in circumstances. And the goal is not perfection and getting rid of sin and who's right and who's wrong. I said to many of you before, I haven't found that kind of way of thinking useful for a long, long while. Enlargement is more of a challenge. Not many people grow out of tough times. You know, denial is a way not to grow. You know what I mean? I wish it wasn't happening to me. If only this were over. You know, it's kind of like when my physical trainer, I mean, I am at 7:15 thinking, if only this was over, and I try games like, if I look like I'm about to collapse, will he stop? You know, the truth of the matter is that if I cop out, I don't grow physically. Yeah. So it's a very good metaphor.
I think also the God's end to be known, you know, whilst it's an end in itself, it seems to be a bit hollow when you're actually a human made in God's image. I mean, it might be great for animals and inanimate objects, but for us who actually are reflections of God to a large extent, there's that added benefit, which is we know ourselves. And that is, if we're allowed the same degree of narcissism that God endures, that is very fulfilling in of itself.
I think I couldn't agree more, and I think that this idea of the knowledge of God, you know, I think I did mention last time, yeah, that the great Calvin sentences that opened the Institute, to know God is to know myself is to know God, that actually to actually experience self-knowledge and self-growth is walking on holy ground. It's what a great phrase I picked up out of my time at Regent, which the patristic fathers talk about, is the deification of humanity. I actually am becoming God-like, very close to God, as I truly know myself. So that in the enlargement, I'm actually, you know, not just imitating God, but becoming to reflect Him exactly as you say.
Perhaps Paul hints at that when he talks about having the mind of Christ.
Yeah. Perhaps that's what he was alluding to. I think it's important we open up these doors, because I feel that our vision of practical tuition and education is just boxed into a very narrow religious box that, you know, I grow as a Christian by reading the Bible, praying, and so on. Whereas what you're saying is that, well, I could grow as a Christian by learning to write, express myself, you know, do all sorts of things that are not, in my mind at the moment, in the religious box, but they're certainly in the life box. You know.
Do you think all those things, both kind of going through tough times and also then growing kind of in yourself, that the enlargement comes when you do those kind of in concert with God? Because, you know, often through difficult times, actually at the end you realise you know God better or in different ways.
Yeah.
And the same with, you know, knowing yourself better. You kind of, A, do it with God. And so as self-knowledge grows and maturity, both kind of Christian maturity and just self-maturity, that often goes in hand with maturity and knowledge of God.
Yeah.
Or that we can only relate to God as much as we know ourselves, kind of thing. Or can relate to others. You know, all this. Anyway.
I think, Nerida, what you're getting at, we definitely have choices. Like, it's not automatic. The growth's not automatic. And inviting kind of our consciousness of God into the process is absolutely critical. And how we do that is worthwhile investigating, not now, but, you know, it's really, really critical. And because it's what I said, that what I've noticed in life is that his growth is a decision that not many people embrace fully. And the sad thing I see are older people who remind me of those gnarled, twisted trees that, as a, you know, are entwined on themselves, and it's a sapling, you could have pulled them apart, but now they're just like bricks. And you see, I certainly have. I mean, people who've, you know, what's been ingrained is you know, bad habits and old ways of thinking, and yeah.
The thing about to know, to be known, the fullest statement of that for is to know is when it's not simply to know, but it's to enter into relationship. That's our core proof, First Corinthians. That's the point. That's the end of faith, I believe, is to know as we know. And the clearest expression we have of this is explanation of it is Jesus talking to the disciples about He and Father in the upper room, which has been hugely influential on the whole development of Trinitarian theology. You know, as Jesus gives this snapshot of how it is that what it looks like for He and Father to be one. It's not this absorption of one into the other as though there are not two, but it's the knowing, you know, I come to know myself as I not only know the other, but as the other knows me.
Knows me. So knowledge is utterly kind of, it's an emergent property between the two. It's not, it's knowing and being known in it, yeah.
One of the things I've been thinking about with this is, I couldn't help think about
Just before you say that, Mark, this is going to get recorded, and so I'll just put that there. So
it's not that important.
No.
I was once at an academic conference on Trinitarian theology, and it was such a parody of this. It's just so dry, and it struck me that, you know, these words like this, I mean, Edwards
way of putting it is just stunning. But this, you know, it didn't wait till the 18th century till somebody said this stuff. It was there, and it's been kind of regarded as orthodox for a very, very long time. And yet, it's a great kind of I think it's worse than an irony that you'd have these words, but the conduct of theology itself doesn't look anything like this. Because the conduct of theology is always basically to keep everything unsullied,
yep.
just keep it okay, or shed a little more light on what we've already got. Those are the two operating principles of theology. So the desire for orthodoxy and doctrine, the first, and the second, largely out of the exegetical and biblical scholars. You know, we'll just take one more look at Ephesians and see if we can get a little bit more out of it, you know? Whereas, if you take this seriously, the purpose of theology is to keep shedding light on a world that continues to amplify.
Yes.
And therefore, mathematics and poetry and medicine and science and engineering, design, these are all theology, if understood this way.
That's wonderful, Mark. I'm glad we recorded that. I think that's important. I mean, I just love that the shedding of light on a world that continues to amplify. That's what you said theology is. Yeah. Which, therefore, and I think what Mark said is very important. So now engineering, architecture, drama, poetry, you can't not... God's everywhere. In this project, God is revealing himself everywhere. And so we're going to be bumping into him everywhere and discovering him. And so
one of the things I think you mentioned this before too is Jeremy Beatty, the English guy who was a classical pianist before he was a theologian. And a lot of people have this idea of theology and, so we'll somehow we'll do a kind of theology and literature, or theology and architecture or something. Whereas. Now, he's quite keen on what theology, what light it might shed on music, but what he's far more interested in, he's built his whole kind of research and teaching life around, is what light does music throw on theology? He runs everything back the other direction and has constantly been trying to encourage people in other aspects of life to run their thinking backwards. Don't if you go from theology to, the problem with it is you keep thinking in terms of those two agendas. You know, what can I say out there to kind of keep music straight? I'll do the audit thing on music, you know, or I'll do the tiny little bit of, oh, I found something else in the Bible that might have something to say about music. This is the problem with Christian schools. This is fundamentally what they do all the time. Rather than saying, let's see if you can work backwards. Because if it is all the amplification of God, if it is all a manifestation of his own heart and relationship, then that's the true source of theology as much as the scriptures are. And you can still do that in a way that preserves the uniqueness of scripture.
This is wonderful, Mark. Does that make sense to people, what Mark is saying? It's a shift. What Mark's done is reversed the arrow that I drew up there, that, you know, when you open the door, as is happening around the world, that Christians have a public voice, then we're kind of implementing God out that way. You know, how does theology and God apply to politics, etc.? What you're saying is actually, in Edwards's magnificent conception, the arrow goes the other way, and it goes back to what I was talking with Dina about at dinner. You know, I think I might have shocked her. Well, I hope I did, because I like doing that to help people learn. It's kind of what you're saying, Mark. I think this is a breakthrough point you've made, because it certainly crystallised what you've just said as kind of crystallised it for me, actually, even as we're talking. What she was saying was, you know, like a dutiful, wonderful young person she is as a believer, that, you know, we must learn to glorify God in situations. It's my job is to, you know, the application is to glorify him here. So this is incredible, you know. I said, look, forget about it, Dean. It's too hard. You know, just, you know. I go to work today, I got to glorify God today. I got to glorify God here. It's just like so much hard work, you know. What if I stop glorifying him? And I said, he doesn't need you glorifying him, you know? He doesn't. What he wants... Yeah, I'm being a bit facetious and putting it... But it's true, actually. No, I won't back away from it. I said, what you have to do is discover God, not glorify him. You know, it's like, oh, God is speaking back to me from this, back to me from this. And whereas I thought I had a private little boxy God that was only at church, he's there in engineering. He's there in architecture. He's there in music. You know, I was stunned. I mean, the big thing for me that stunned me was that my whole life of organisational... He's there in organisations. He's there in human social systems. He's there in creativity. And so the arrow goes back the other way, because what Edwards has done is says, well, the split's wrong from the start. That's his project. Expect to discover him everywhere. Now, that will take a long time. You know, that's an agenda for life, because he's bigger than we are, right? That's why it's an infinite enlargement of discovery. And of course, as I discover him, I'm filled with wonder, filled with appreciation, the knowledge of God. My heart leaps for joy. That's why I said last time, you know, I think almost the greatest thing Edwards wrote was that letter on the spider.
Yeah. Yeah.
10 pages on a spider. He was just mesmerised by it. Because the web and, yeah, I know, it's strange things. But, I mean, he just saw the infrastructure of God in that. And so this is why I introduced the notion of discovering God. And, of course, then you do glorify him. I mean, that's why I'm playing with words to some extent.
It's interesting, though. One of the things I think that's... a lot of people have said, in a sense, theology needs to come backwards, so-called natural theology, whatever else. But what's happened is that because a lot of people have started from a static understanding of God, one that isn't genuinely Trinitarian, even if they use those words, then somehow or another the magnificence and wonder of God's expression in Christ gets collapsed, and you then can have a kind of natural theology of, you know, we've discovered God here, we've discovered God there, that in a sense works against preserving the specialness of who Christ is. And again, I think what's happened in theology, especially in more conservative circles, is this reaction that says, if you go down this track of thinking the world is speaking back, of God is speaking back through the world, that's where you'll always end up. You'll always end up in this kind of liberalized place where I've really lost Christ. And yet, if you go from the richness of Trinitarian understanding that Edwards has got, you say, I don't have to be afraid about that.
Yes, yes, it's all his home.
Yeah, and theology, conservative theology, to me, is largely driven out of fear. But if you can shake that fear and have this sense like, you know, rather than I must glorify God today, in other words, meaning there must be some moral thing I've got to avoid and some moral thing I've got to do because that's how God will get glorified. If instead you say, well, the trees glorify God by being trees and the fish glorify God by being fish and I'm a human being, I'll glorify God by being a human being. It'll take care of itself. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
The question, as you said, is discovering. That is just move towards him in everything you do.
Yeah, this is wonderful. So let me just make a final point that we might take a bit of a break. And this is, in a way, I think, probably how, as you discover, I think what happens is you get enriched. Mm. And then you can actually begin to act in the world more like God. So the loop comes around. And I just want to give you a practical example of that, and then we'll close. Sorry, not close, we'll have a break and come back. And when we come back, what we're going to do is actually do, in a sense, what Mark said. We're actually going to go to an area of human knowledge, which is cognitive theory, and we're going to discover God in kind of how we think. And Edwards did a great deal of that. So it's one place I can discover God. And so we'll do that after we have a break. But just in terms of the loop back, because I did, you know, last time, you know, some people challenged me to say how, because, you know, I said I think I live in a seamless life, a seamless world in my mind, and I could almost at any time in the work I'm involved in, you know, just turn left and say, well, here's how I've discovered God. So let me just give you a very practical example. we, you know, our work is to help large-scale change. Human beings involved in trying to implement seriously big change. And we have a model, which I won't go through now, called the ABCD model, of which the B is vision. And we're the strongest people in the country by a long, long way on vision. I think everyone would say that about our competitors, people like, you know, Boston Consulting and others, people who now work, say, you want to have vision, don't talk to us, whether you go to second round, they'll do the vision thing. So vision, you know, in the B, the word that we often use, and I explain to people, is telos, which is the end. And we human beings are teleologically wired. We are creatures of the end. And any change is far more productive if the end is expressed. And mostly it's not. So a very practical example we're doing at the moment, our largest project at the moment is with Rio Tinto, the huge iron ore producer, and they're introducing a thing called the Mine of the Future, which you might have heard about. It's been on TV a lot. Essentially, they're going to have driverless 300-ton trucks, which are being remotely operated from Perth 2,000 miles away. It's like science fiction. And the people implementing it, who are leading it, you know, their sense is, well, we are doing it almost step one, step two, step three, step four. And everyone's saying, why are we doing this? What's our goal? And you can't just say making money. They think that's it, okay, but they want other stuff. Is this good for human beings? Is this, and what's it going to look like? There's this drive in everybody to picture the telos. And we as believers, the telos means hope, and it brings in a lot of stuff to do with ethical purpose, lots of things, but nonetheless it's a big, big territory. And so, because now, for years and years and years, you know, through Mark's influence and others in our dialogue, we realise God is a God of the telos. And only the Judeo-Christian tradition gave the world telos. You want to go back in history. The whole idea of enterprise, achievement, is entirely indebted to the Judeo-Christian tradition, or 90%. Most other traditions are in an endless cycle of determinists, like reincarnation. What do I want to do anything for in that world? So, having discovered the telos, enriched ourselves, we much more wisely can, I would say, probably the most powerful thing my faith would give me in these workshops. I don't say, look, guys, we're all Christians, it's all about the New Jerusalem, and that's what I do. I don't go that, but I'm thinking a lot of it. But I declare, human beings are creatures of the telos, of the end. So your job as a leader is to describe the end. And with a great deal of confidence, and I'm saying that because I know that this is smart, because it's how God is structured the universe. So that's an example, a practical example of, you know, in my life anyway, of how that loop sort of occurs. Let's just take a bit of a pause there and get ourselves a cup of tea or something, and then we'll just come back and do a little bit more before we part.